Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. And he's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And I guess there's no way to get any real sense of where Senator Chuck Hagel's nomination stands. It hasn't really been announced, but the AIPAC lobby and the neoconservatives are working overtime to scuttle it. But on the other hand, Senator Kerry's going to fly through. Of course, there's some mischief there on the part of the Republicans because his seat then becomes open in Massachusetts and they have a chance of picking it up in 2014. Do you know do you have any idea of what's going to happen with Hagel? Do you think the president's going to announce him and stand up for him?
I think he will, Ian. I think the defeat, as it were, over Ambassador Rice still rankles in the White House from everything that I hear, and I think he's pretty determined to go ahead with Hagel, thinking that he can he really can outflank the Israel lobby at this point. But this is a hard prediction to make because this White House can change on a dime, as you know, and if the pressure mounts in the right places at the right time, he could abandon Hagel as well.
So, and touching on Kerry, what about the idea of McCain and Lindsey Graham, who have really been made his life as difficult as possible for Obama at every turn? It almost feels like McCain has is embittered by his defeat and can't get over it. And he sabotages anything that Obama does at every turn. But in this case, he's all in favor of Kerry, and I wonder whether there's an ulterior motive.
Well, Kerry is obviously the establishment candidate in that sense, and I think particularly after they got rid of Rice, and incidentally, I think from a progressive point of view that they may have done the left a favor in doing that. Her record was less than sterling, but in any event, Kerry is a fairly safe and sound appointment from their point of view. There really are, as you know, Ian, two John Kerry's. There's the early John Kerry, whose initial record in the Senate, and he was elected in 1984, his initial record all those years on the Foreign Relations Committee was really quite hopeful. He's the was a leading light in the Iran-Contra hearings. He was at the forefront of exposing BCCI and the Panama machinations and so on. Now, of course, as Larry pointed out in your earlier segment, he has become very much the quintessential establishment figure and covering his rear at every turn. He's acceptable now to a good many Republicans as well as the Democratic Party. So one can only hope that John Kerry won at some point may reemerge and reassert himself. But I see no real chance of that in the short run. He's very much, as Larry pointed out, on the wrong conventional side of all of these issues, from Iran to all of the issues pending for this administration in terms of the environment, climate change, the global economic crisis, which is still very much with us, the fundamental root foreign policy issues, which Hillary Clinton has done, a marvelous job of ignoring for the past 4 years, are still very much with us and unresolved.
So Roger Morris again served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Between the Graves, about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia. And we're talking about the nominations of expected nomination of Chuck Hagel to be Secretary of Defense, which the AIPAC lobby are trying to scuttle, and the nomination of John Kerry to become Secretary of State, which, of course, will go breezing through the Senate. You know, Roger, I've known Kerry, and I actually did organize the first fundraiser for him when he ran for president, way before he announced, back before he took the critical vote on the Iraq war resolution. And it was a really interesting experience. You know, this is one of the reasons why I really detest the way our politics run, because it's all about money. And this was all about money. It was about raising enough money to scare off the other candidates. So money was being used as in effect as a way to, by tapping into the Hollywood money, because we had a bunch of movie stars and others, you know, everybody paid $1,000 a head. And I had to organize it all. And I just ended up thinking what a dreadful experience the whole thing was. And of course, that was before the floodgates were opened by the Supreme Court with the Citizens United decision. But anyway, the long and the short of it was that at that time, in this really lovely setting in California, most of the people that had paid their thousands of dollars to meet this prospective presidential candidate really lit into him on the Iraq war and saying, don't vote, don't vote. He heard it so loud and clear, and yet he did vote. And his rationale for voting for that bogus war resolution against the advice of the Senate Intelligence Committee, chaired by Bob Graham, who forced the NIE in the first place. The White House didn't, Bush White House didn't even want an NIE. They were so cocky about going to war. And everybody on the Intelligence Committee, except Feinstein, voted against the resolution because they knew it was phony. There were no WMD, no evidence. Yet Kerry and Senator Clinton all voted for it. And Kerry's rationale was, if I don't vote for this, I'll never get a vote in the South. Well, guess what? He didn't get a vote in the South anyway.
That's right. You know, I think your anecdote is very well taken. He's one of the classic victims of the utter corruption of this money tyranny that we have in American politics. Even quite a wealthy man like Kerry, who comes, of course, of a somewhat aristocratic background and married wealth, has enjoyed wealth all his life, not immune from the necessity of accumulating this mass fortune that's necessary for running for office. I remember John Kerry, Ian, very well, that beautiful day in 1971 when he first appeared on the national scene, testifying before the Foreign Relations Committee on the war in Vietnam, made his memorable statements about not being the last man to die for a mistake. He was accompanied, of course, by a small ragtag army of Vietnam War veterans, many of whom were grievously wounded and highly decorated, who all threw their medals and decorations over the fence, as you may remember, there on Capitol Hill. That was the early John Kerry I spoke about a minute ago, and he remained somewhat true to those principles as a young lieutenant governor of Massachusetts under Mike Dukakis, and then when he first ran for the Senate, a rather distinguished record. If you go back and look at some of the committee reports that Kerry authored as a young senator on corruption and the drug trade, on the compromise of the CIA, and particularly a policy in Central and Latin America, it's all very, for its time, avant-garde. But he does, of course, slowly adapt and slowly surrender to what's called in Washington the encirclement. And by the time he becomes a contender for national office, which I think was always his ambition, almost from the very beginning, by the time he's contending for the presidency, he's utterly compromised. Now, one can only hope, this is the twilight appointment of his career, one can only hope that this is a moment when he may find the courage and the independence to stand up. He's not going to be running for office again. I don't think he has any pretense to the presidency beyond the second Obama administration. And I think this is the moment for the real John Kerry, the early John Kerry, to emerge. But that may be something of a pipe dream.
So, Roger Morris, let's turn in the last few minutes then to the other story that I've been covering. I played the entire tape of the solicitation of General Petraeus by Fox News, their emissary, Katie McFarlane, their national security advisor, reporter, had gone to Kabul to meet with Petraeus, conveying the message from Roger Ailes that Roger Ailes wants Petraeus to run for president, excuse me, against Obama. They're not happy with the Republican field, with the feckless field that they had with Romney, etc. And that they promise him the world. You know that Rupert Murdoch will bankroll it. Roger Ailes will take leave of absence to run the campaign. All you have to do is just sign on the dotted line. This tape ends up revealed by Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, but it comes out on the style section. It's buried in the back. Nobody in the press has picked up on it. I did a piece about it when it came out, and then I did a piece last Sunday with the former CIA officer Bob Baer, who took the ball further by suggesting that actually the CIA it was an inside job. They got rid of Petraeus because he was dumped on them by Obama, who wanted to get him off the street and inside the tent before Fox News recruited him. So they put him at CIA. The CIA hated him, and they eventually found a way to get rid of him. So to me, this is an extraordinary story. I mean, and I just am dumbfounded. I mean, Carl Bernstein wrote a piece in the Guardian, basically saying the same. He said, "What happened? Why hasn't this been reported? Do you have any answers to why the press have been so silent?"
I have to say first that I think it's one of the most disgraceful episodes in American journalism in a very, very long while. This is a major story. It's eavesdropping on a veritable coup d'etat, given the kind of power that Murdoch exercises with his wealth and with his media empire and all the rest. This is constitutionally, it's interference from abroad, as it were, after all. Everything about it just smells to high heaven, and my own sense of why this has not been taken up is very much the same that Carl wrote about in The Guardian. I think there's fear and loathing, but a lot of fear of Fox and of that empire in the rest of the media. I think there is this ineradicable shallowness, which we face all the time. If it's not our story, if we didn't break it, somehow it's relatively unimportant. And, of course, the grand scandal here begins with the Washington Post, in which the managing editor had the utter absurd temerity to say this was not a major news story and only a media buzz story, which belonged in the style section. No, I think this is fascinating. I agree with Bob. I know that there was enormous discontent at the agency over the Petraeus appointment. There was an obvious feeling that he was being dumped and exiled there, and that they deserved better. They had served Obama fairly faithfully and well when the appointment was made. People in the agency, after all, knew what the media was not reporting, what the public largely did not know, which was that Petraeus was a papier-mâché figure, very largely a creature of his publicity agents, and was not the kind of director that the agency thought it deserved or wanted. Now, what the exact machinations were, we can only guess. There are so many unanswered questions. Another scandal by the media. Here we have the toppling of this supposedly major figure in American military and political life, and The Paula Broadwell story is pursued only so far. The Petraeus story is truncated. Yeah, I think this is one that historians will chew into and well, Ian, in years to come.
So, Roger Marsh, why then, do the rivals to Fox, why is the rest of the press complicitous in covering up Fox News's criminal behavior? And this, it's an outrage what Murdoch and Ailes tried to do.
They really haven't covered very well the scandal in Britain either. I do think there is this strange fraternity of corruption, I think, in the media. Of course, MSNBC is not an exact replica of Fox, but rather too close. The other networks, I think, fear the sheer potential that Fox has for hurting their markets, hurting their advertising, hurting their audience. We haven't seen any genuine civil war, after all this petty bickering between celebrity talk show hosts. Is not the kind of serious network civil war that you could have if Fox seriously went after mainstream coverage, with which there is much discontent, as you know, always in the body politic, particularly in the constituency, the right wing and sort of know nothing constituency that Fox panders to. So that I genuinely think that Carl was right about the fear factor in the media's reaction. But this is, again, one of those many stories that requires genuine digging, requires genuine cultivation of sources. I have no doubt that the agency was capable of and probably in the end disposed to do something like this. The Paula Broadwell story has just, in effect, vanished. I remember the very, very portentous comment by her father saying, well, there's a lot more to this than has come out. Now, of course, nothing more has indeed come out. So I just think, as I said, Ian, it's a major scandal. But we move in this age from scandal to scandal in terms of what the media is doing and not doing. And of course, they are very complicitous in the failures that we ascribe largely to politics and to government, because government does indeed, in the end, respond to how it's covered.
But it should be manifestly clear, Roger Marsh, to everybody what a toxic and debilitating effect that Rupert Murdoch has had on the press, just from the disgraceful scandals that come out of England. So we know what he's done to journalism, and yet the FCC are about to allow him to buy the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune, it seems.
Syndrome of what I would call this ugly worship of wealth and power in America. Until he really commits an overt crime somehow in America, which is not impossible, he will not only be tolerated, but his influence will be heeded and rewarded. As long as he has the capacity to hurt, to punish, in the political world, Washington will pay attention and will pay deference.
Well, but he is also, I think, he's largely responsible for why our politics are so poisonous and so strident and so polarized. Fox News has really pushed the envelope in that regard. I thank you for joining us, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new forthcoming book is Between the Graves. It's about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the NRA's bizarre press conference.